This is a CBC Radio 1 podcast.
It's Tuesday, July 10th. Barry Bonds is getting the start for the National League in Major League Baseball's All-Star Game tonight. He goes into the game just four home runs shy of Hank Aaron's all-time record of 755. And many fans are outraged that someone suspected of doping might break one of baseball's most cherished records. Currently, President Bush is preparing a full pardon in case it's proven that Bonds did take steroids. And while he's at it, he might just erase all his strikeouts from the record, too. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Petty. You're listening to the summer edition of The Current. The Pakistan military is moving to end the standoff in Islamabad's Red Mosque. Troops are moving room by room through the large complex. Dozens have died so far in fighting between Pakistani military forces and Islamic militants holed up in the notoriously radicalized mosque. The Red Mosque has been a hotbed of militancy for years, and in a moment, we will hear from someone who spent some time there just before the standoff began. But first, for the latest on the confrontation and what led to it, I'm joined by Declan Walsh. He is the correspondent for the British newspaper The Guardian, and he's in Islamabad. Declan, hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
What can you tell me about this government offensive against the Red Mosque?
It started this morning, Kathleen, at 4 o'clock local time. A group of commandos from what's known as the Special Services Group here launched an offensive against the mosque. This is the seventh day of the siege of the mosque that started after a clash between government troops and militant students within the mosque last Tuesday. So the assault started. The commandos planted explosives around the perimeter of the mosque. They breached the defences, and then almost immediately a very intense firefight started, and that's still continuing now. It seems that the militants within the mosque were incredibly well prepared. They seem, on the face of it, to be very heavily armed, and they basically fought the Pakistani soldiers every step of the way. I was at a press conference an hour or two ago where the spokesman for the Pakistani armed forces was saying that step by step, room by room, hall by hall, the militants are impeding their way. They say that the real fears now are for several hundred women and children who are presumed to be within the mosque but haven't been located yet. They're thought to be in a basement, a heavily fortified basement room that's been protected by these militants. So there's still a great deal at play at the moment here in Islamabad.
Declan, the warning had come from President Musharraf that eventually this would come down to either surrender or be killed. How was the decision reached that today was the day that government forces would make their move?
It's been a very difficult decision, I think, for President Musharraf. All along, his government has said that their prime concern has been to avoid large-scale civilian casualties in this operation. But over the weekend, positions on both sides hardened. After a lot of fighting over the previous days, President Musharraf said that for the militants, there was really only one solution to this, surrender or be killed. Subsequently, the militants themselves replied in a very belligerent way. The chief cleric, his name is Abdul Rashid Ghazi, issued a statement to the national press saying that he was prepared to die as a martyr within the mosque, and he said that he hoped that his death and the death of his followers would spark an Islamic revolution here in Pakistan.
When you say positions hardened, can you describe how they hardened and why?
There have been some early opportunities, it seemed, for a peaceful end to the solution, to the siege early on, but those slipped away very quickly. The fighting continued every day in and around the mosque. The government would sporadically attack the mosque with machine gun fire onto the perimeter walls, and they occasionally detonated very loud explosions. And these tactics were really intended as a way of scaring the militants within the mosque to try to persuade them to give up the fight. But when it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, and indeed when the Pakistani forces suffered some serious casualties themselves, including the special forces commander who was killed a couple of days ago, and then it started to become clear that a peaceful end to this crisis was really slipping further and further away. And I think that's more or less how we got to the situation we're in now. And yesterday there was, for about 6 or 8 hours, a real hope that at the last minute there could be a peaceful solution. There was a delegation of clerics and one senior politician who went to the front door of the mosque. The fighting had stopped. They managed to establish communication with the cleric inside and started some fresh negotiations, but they collapsed in the middle of the night last night. And the politician came out, and then a couple of minutes later, the final assault started.
Let's talk a bit more about Abdul Rashid Ghazi. Tell me who he is and what specifically is motivating him.
Abdul Rashid Ghazi and his brother Abdul Aziz are really the engines behind the Red Mosque in Islamabad. The mosque is the oldest mosque in Islamabad. It's been around since the mid-1960s when the city was actually built. But they've really just come to prominence in the last 6 months. They've recruited, they've encouraged a large number of students in this madrasa, boys as well as girls, offering them free food, free education. And in return, they demand their students, if you like, to participate in these vigilante activities here in Islamabad over the last 6 months. They say they want to introduce Sharia law into Pakistan because the country is an Islamic country that has lost its way. And they started to enforce their own anti-vice campaign in the streets around the mosque. For instance, they started to abduct women who they accused of being prostitutes. They even abducted a number of policemen at one stage. They intimidated traders who were selling music CDs or Hollywood movies. And they generally embarrassed President Musharraf severely by challenging the rest of his government in a spot that's only a couple of streets away from most potent symbols of power here in Pakistan, the parliament, the Supreme Court. Even President Musharraf's office is less than a mile from the Jamia Hafsa and Red Mosque compound.
And Declan, how many people inside the Red Mosque are those people that you describe who are a part of this movement of Abdul Rashid Ghazi, and how many are just innocent bystanders?
Well, Kathleen, that's been a very contentious matter here over the last week between the government and the officials within the mosque. The government claims that at this stage most of the women and children within the mosque are effectively human hostages. But the truth of the matter is that most of the women and children went to the mosque of their own volition originally, certainly. But the information we have is that they're being led, or most of the fighting, if you like, that we're seeing, it's been led by a hard core of what the government describes as 50 to 60 militants. They're saying some of these men have experience fighting in other conflicts, such as in Kashmir or Afghanistan. There have been suggestions that some of them have been linked to an assassination attempt on the Prime Minister, or indeed to the assassination, to the beheading rather, of the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Carlson years ago. So the government has painted these people as extremist hardliners who need to be taken out, basically. But they've also, if you like, painted the hundreds, sometimes some of the thousands of students who were inside the mosque as being innocent bystanders. I think the truth is probably a little bit more complex. Some of the children who have left the mosque during the siege have said that some of their colleagues were staying there because they wanted to stay, because I suppose they felt some sort of sense of community even within this mosque that was under siege.
Declan, given the complexity that you describe, what exactly, in your view, is at stake for President Musharraf in all this?
There's an enormous amount at stake for the president. If you like, this siege means different things to different constituencies that he has to cater to. He is a key ally of the West, and particularly of the United States. So through the actions he's taking at the moment, he has to show that he is a committed ally in the what America terms the war on terror. He has to show that he is willing and able to take the action that's necessary to crack down on radical extremists, even within, or particularly in the heart of his own capital. For ordinary Pakistanis, it's a little bit different. He has to show that he's able to end this crisis that really has embarrassed his government quite severely and brought a lot of criticism over the last number of months, but without inflicting major casualties and, if you like, perpetuating the idea that the military is a very blunt instrument in the hands of people in power here in Pakistan.
Declan Walsh, good of you to do this. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Declan Walsh is a correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. He's in Islamabad. Among the hundreds of people still inside the Red Mosque, a group of young stick-wielding women clad in black burqas. They are known as the Hafsa Brigade. Over the last 6 months, there are reports of them acting as a kind of morality police for the mosque's militant clerics, stopping other women in the street, berating them for not wearing headscarves. Most recently, they've been accused of kidnapping seven Chinese nationals who they say were running a brothel. Fazeh Hafsal Khan spent some time inside the Red Mosque among the members of the so-called Hafsa Brigade, and that was just before the current standoff began. She was born in Pakistan. She teaches English at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and she's also the editor of Shattering the Stereotypes, Muslim Women Speak Out. She's in New York City this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
What did you think when you heard about this all-out assault by Pakistani forces?
Well, you know, I was there just a day or two before the army surrounded the Jamia Hafsa and the Red Mosque. And when I came back and, you know, then I was subsequently in Lahore and talking to various people about my visit, it seemed that a lot of Pakistani people sort of had an idea, an inkling that something was going to come down, and that action by the army was fairly imminent. So when I heard, I can't say that I was totally surprised, but then having just been there and had this long sort of chat with both Ghazi Abdul-Rashid and then several women students and teachers of the Jamia Hafsa, you know, that was, you know, had put me in a mind where I thought maybe, I mean, because he sounded, you know, reasonable, which sounds sort of a strange thing to say, but that they were really wanting to negotiate with the state, and that their agenda was not to have a state within the state, and that they were being misread and misunderstood and so on and so forth. So then when I heard this, I was obviously, part of me was just, my God, you know, these people are not going to get out of there alive. And that's always hard, loss of life.
Do you have a sense about what might have changed? You talk about how he, as you put it, sounded reasonable. And we heard Declan Walsh saying that, you know, that there was some sense that negotiations could mm-hmm. produce something. But then, you know, very recently positions hardened. So but just based on your time inside, do you have any insight?
I don't. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I'm not sure exactly what could have happened, what transpired in these conversations. But when I spoke to both Ghazi Abdul-Rashid and these women, their sense was very much that, I mean, they were very critical of the Pakistani army, of the politics and the policies being followed by Musharraf, which they saw as totally keeling over to a Western imperialist agenda, and also very harsh on, you know, the poor people of Pakistan itself. I mean, there was a lot of criticism directed at the elite of Pakistani society, and at, you know, obviously they see the army as in cahoots and following a sort of a Bush agenda in Muslim land. So there was very much a sense that what we stand for, what we represent, you know, however mistaken that is and crazy or whatever, but from their own words, I'm just reporting what I heard, is that, you know, we are the voice of a large part of the Pakistani population. People come to us, they want us to intervene, help the government stop doing, you know, make the government's sort of crack down on obscenity, on economic injustice, right, social injustice, and so on. And so that may have been the position that, you know, I mean, if they had some demands and the army is absolutely refusing to listen to them at this point, then, and, you know, and the people in power, then I guess there's a standoff. And plus there was a sense of, you know, we want, even the women kept chanting, yes, there is going to be a fight. They were, because I asked them, and they said, yes, there's going to be a war between the religious forces and the secular forces, and Islam will win. So there was that kind of fanatic element to their talk. There's undoubtedly so. So it's probably a combination of these factors and their sense that they're engaged in some sort of, greater glory of Islam stuff. I don't know.
You spoke about how they believe that they represent many people in Pakistan. What is the reality?
It's from all the people that I spoke to, which, of course, most of them are, I would have to say, the elite class, there's absolutely no sympathy. But also from, let's say, the people like my mother's cook or the young man who was driving me around in Lahore, none of these people that I talked to said they had any sympathies with, certainly not with the tactics of the Jamia Hafsa and the Lal Masjid Brigades. They said they certainly don't represent our point of view. Yes, they, these people are also critical of class issues and so on in Pakistan, and they suffer from bad economic policies and this growing gap between rich and poor. But they don't endorse what was coming out of the Lal Masjid, not at all. They're very angry at them, and many of them said, I hope that the army will take care of them. And, why hasn't Musharraf acted before?
Part of what I find
interesting, it's difficult to say, yeah.
Sorry to interject, but what I find interesting, a couple of times you mentioned, you've talked about the sort of economic motivation behind this, mm-hmm. as well as the moral motivation. And I think that is being missed in a lot of the discussion about what's going on here.
Yeah, I agree. And those were the conversations I had with people who wanted to know what I saw, what I heard, etc. Were very curious after I had gone into this space. And I think it is being missed, and I think it's very crucial that we think about it and we address it, because I really do think that these kinds of movements, however small or large scale they are, is difficult to gauge in Pakistan at the moment. But if one is to believe these guys, all of the people and the women entering and the students are all people who are coming of their own free will. I mean, the women all claim they came because they wanted to and because they're fed up of what they see as really the consequences of a particular kind of globalization, neoliberal trade models, which have created a world in which particularly these countries in the third world really have become beggars and are poorer than ever. And in fact, as a result of a lot of these policies, the rich or the elite in these countries have gotten ever richer, and the poor are finding, and even the so-called middle classes are finding it very, very difficult to cope. The principal of the school of Jamia Hafsa, Umme Hassan, said to me, the worst thing is for people who are called Sufed Posh in Urdu, which is people who have to present a front of being, they're the sort of, middle class sort of people who you would never imagine need to work, to make even enough money to put food on the table. And that's what they're struggling against. They can't afford the basic amenities of life for their loved ones, for their children, for their families. She did a whole breakdown of salaries, even of people who are working in the cities, people who are attached to households as mm-hmm. servants or as cooks or drivers. And she says, how are we supposed to survive? So, yeah, they kept hitting on the economic thing. And one of these women kept talking about, she had obviously done a good study of the Wealth of Nations and Adam Smith. And, they were quoting all these people. So they weren't stupid women, or illiterate or anything like that.
With the minute that we have left, then based on that, then to what extent is what has been going on inside this mosque just about the people in there, and to what extent is it emblematic of what's going on across Pakistan? Even if, as you say, they don't necessarily represent the majority, to what extent does the turmoil represent what's going on mm-hmm, across the country?
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a good question. And, I don't think there are glib answers, but I think everything that I saw or heard or that I've been studying for so many years indicates that the turmoil that you see in Pakistan and countries like Pakistan is at bottom an economic turmoil. And until we address those issues, I think these kinds of movements, extremist, fanatic movements, are going to keep cropping up. They are the reactions of people, and in this case, they represent maybe a small vocal, fanatic element. But the anger generally and the dis-ease generally of a population that can see this increasing gap between the rich and the poor, that is definitely at play here in all of these reactions to a world that is just not meeting the needs of the majority of the people, including in Pakistan. Absolutely. I think there are connections, and I think it behooves us as scholars and as thinkers to think about those and the anger at a world, at a unipolar world where one power, one country has so much and the others have nothing.
Your insight is most appreciated. Thank you for helping us understand this better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Fawzia Afzal Khan is a professor of English at Montclair State University. She was in New York City. That's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, 9 o'clock in Newfoundland, as well as on the Sirius Satellite Radio 137. And to find out more about the program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, that's all one word, at cbc.ca. Or you can call our feedback line toll-free at 1-877-287-7366. And as always, our mailing address is P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Petty.